live from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100, it's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now, here's your hosts for Chatterbox.
Good evening, everyone. This is the Chatterbox Video Game Radio Show. Once again, my name is Alon.
And my name is Ara.
And my name is Rich.
And we're one very happy bunch. We're going to talk about the video game industry. And this week, we actually have a guest. Ara and I got the chance to play some Schizoid, which is a game on Xbox Live Arcade.
Yeah, Schizoid.
Schizoid.
Yeah.
Schizoid.
It's 2-1 here.
Is it?
Yeah, now first you two actually played it before I ever saw it.
You said,
hey, there's this
game. Yeah, we played the demo.
There's this game where, like, you're red, you're blue, it's pretty cool. It's kind of like Ikaruga, Pac-Man, and Gauntlet all sort of match together, and you should totally play it.
Yeah, you know what was funny? Because I got this email for a press release for the game, right? And, you know, when I get press releases, I roll my eyes.
Yes, because we get
very, very far into the back of my head. And, you know, I'm just like, okay, what is this weird game? And then, oh, okay, this looks like a kid's game, and like, okay.
A kid's game?
Yeah, no, okay, that's an old NES Three Stooges reference that no one will get. Anyway, you know, I was just like, oh, okay, this is whatever, and I just, you know, subsequently just pressed delete and ignored it. and then I saw it online, and then, you know, I'm like, oh, here's that Schizoid game, right?
You mean Schizoid?
Schizoid.
Sure, whatever.
But okay. He thought Schizoid in his head, so.
Okay.
He's still wrong.
And, you know, I pronounce what I see. What can I say? and then I was looking online, and now there's not a lot of good Xbox Live Arcade games. And I've been, as you all can probably share the same experience about, I've just, like, every time I see a new Xbox Live Arcade game, I'm kind of very hesitant even to download and to play because there's so much garbage out there.
The irony, of course, is that the last 2 weeks we've talked about nothing other than Braid.
There's some good ones coming in.
This week, Castle Crashers tomorrow. That game's going to be sweet.
Okay, we'll see about that.
That game is sweet.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Anyway, so I download it and I'm like, okay, I'm going to play it. And you and me played the demo first, right?
Yeah.
And I was completely uninterested as thoroughly as possible until we actually started playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then I was like, wow, this was really, really cool. And I was really impressed primarily by the fact that this was a very, very mechanics-heavy design, which, I mean, I guess you'll see more of that on Xbox Live Arcade games. But it was like this was an actual like game that was based around like a very, very small, efficient, really, really ingenious mechanics idea, right? And those are the kinds of games I really like, and I don't get to see a lot of those. So that's what I was really impressed by right away. The second thing that I was impressed by was just that, like, okay, wow, this is actually implemented, like, pretty well. Like, this is a pretty slick execution.
I found some typos in the menu system. I had some issues there.
It's not perfect, right? It's not, I mean, I do have my criticisms of the game.
Well, you and I played it last night for, like, a good 70-some levels until it got too hard to beat without repeating a level over and over and over.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I was actually really impressed with that, too, because I never play with the headset, you know? Because all you hear in the headset is people complaining and yelling and screaming and people speaking in French and whatever.
Some sort of discussion of my nuts usually arises.
Right. But then I just realized when we were playing, I'm like, wait a minute, I'm really enjoying, you know, actually communicating to you verbally even though you're not in the room. And I realized it was because, well, there's only one person there, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's a two-player game that
it
you play the
same
time.
It did make for a much more comprehensive.
Somebody you know outside of Xbox Live.
Well, in this case. Right.
Yeah.
But even if it were just someone I didn't know already, it would have been the same.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have that cacophony that you usually have on Xbox Live with, you know, the headset. So yeah. That was pretty sweet. I guess we haven't told them what this game is exactly about.
I guess we should. Like I said earlier, you guys had described it as sort of a Gauntlet, Ikaruga, Pac-Man mashup. Mm-hmm. I think the only reason we call it Gauntlet is because sometimes there's a million enemies coming.
There's a million enemies, and you're like, oh, ka-cha, ka-cha.
It's top view.
And it's top view. All right, so let's describe the game. I will try to do so in a concise way. So it's a two-player game by virtue of the way the game is. There's no option to play one player. You can be one person controlling two ships or two
Or you can have the players. AI take over the second one, which is actually pretty decent
but
I played it.
A key point to the game is that there are two players playing, whether it's AI or one brain controlling two people, which is really friggin' hard, or most likely just co-op with two people.
I have some questions to Jamie about that one.
So anyway, you control these two vehicles. Each has their own color. One, and they look sort of organic, so I feel weird calling them vehicles.
I was going to say, are they vehicles or just things?
Whatever. It's a video game. So they're they're each are these circles that look kind of like some organic alien thing.
All right.
And so one's red, one's blue. And there's a bunch of enemies on the screen as well, and they will be either blue or red, or in some cases neutral. And in the case of neutral, that means they can hurt either enemy. But normally, a blue player can destroy a blue enemy, and a red player can destroy a red enemy, and not vice versa. I mean,
the opposite color is dangerous to you, right?
Exactly.
And you just kill things by running into them.
Yeah, but what creates the gameplay is that the enemies are also intelligent about who they go after. So they will, like a red enemy will go towards a blue player, but he will repel away from the red player. So if you have the red player in between the blue and the red, the blue player and the red enemy, then that red enemy won't go after the blue guy because the red one's in the middle and he doesn't want to touch the red one. Mm-hmm. And so part of it, when you're playing two player, it's like, okay, I want to go near this enemy who's especially hard to beat because he's just as fast as you are virtually and a little bit more agile.
But some of them do different things. Though,
yeah,
right?
they all interact differently, but it's interesting because you want to get him to come closer to you so that your friend can destroy him. So like as the opposing color of this difficult enemy, I have to approach him carefully and then run away and swap positions with the other player so that he can go kill him. And so there's a lot of this strange dynamic of wanting to go near the enemy, but not wanting to go near the enemy, getting too close and getting hurt. And then the other player has to come in and save you. And I was telling Ara last night, like when I get in a situation where I'm following an enemy to kill it, which is in itself following Ara, like it was weird. I realized that I care a lot more about just the hunt between the enemy and myself.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Than the fact that I'm trying to save Ara from death. I care much more about my success than his death.
And I mentioned that maybe that says something about your personality.
I think it does. It means I'm a little bit self-centered. It clicked to me in the head. I was like, I don't really care if he dies. I just want to make sure I kill this dude.
Dude, and, that's the same thing in like Gauntlet, though. You're like, oh, I just need to get more kills or any kind of game like that. I think most people, at least me, always focuses on killing the enemy rather than bailing my friend out.
Well, the interesting point to this game is that you share lives.
Yeah.
If he dies, I die.
And you can't really do that. I mean, like, you've learned very quickly that you can't totally just go on your own because you'll die right away. You do have to, like, maintain some sort of proximity.
Well, yeah. I mean, the proximity is one thing, but you also have to just actively work with your partner. If you're completely independent of each other, it won't happen.
The thing that I found that was really cool when we were playing was that you kind of have, like, these two layers of gameplay happening at the same time. I don't know if I want to call it gameplay, but that's the word that came to my mind. Basically, I mean, we have the action that's going on just in terms of what you're doing on the screen, but then, like, you're talking to each other and kind of, like, verbally strategizing, right? But since that type of action happens on a much slower level, I don't know, I just found it really, really interesting because you have, like, this slow verbal thing going on, right? But then the gameplay is faster than what you can actually, you know, talk about in real time, even though you're just talking in real time anyway.
That doesn't prevent me from trying, though.
No,
Ara, no, turn down so I can go, like, intercept this guy and cut him off at the pass.
It was really interesting. It's like, you know, maybe if we were, like, really hardcore into it, we could come up with some kind of, like, shorthand jargon so that we could, like, verbally communicate faster. I don't know.
I don't know if I'm capable of that.
Well, it's, you know, I know someone somewhere would be. Some geek in a dark
basement.
I can see that.
People played a lot together, they'd have some sort of shorthand verbal communication.
I did have my little concerns. Like when I was playing, I played a lot of single player before Ara and I got to play. And where I was playing with the bot, you know, that it's actually pretty good. Like it has some failures and that's, I guess, to be expected because it's not human. But humans have plenty of faults as well.
That was another thing that, like, I'm really curious about what Jamie has to say about that.
But how just, they programmed it?
It just seems like you can't really tell if they did certain things deliberately in terms of decreasing the performance of the AI bot or if it was just something that they couldn't do, you know?
Yeah, and we should point out to those who might not realize it, it's a lot easier to create a perfect AI than to create one that seems more human.
Speaking for myself, when I played the demo, I died more times than the bot did, so that's all I'm saying.
So they won't use you as the model for the next generation bot.
Yeah.
It one thing I didn't like is that you get to the point where like it rewards you for getting a gold, meaning you didn't die on a particular level. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to get gold on a lot of levels, and so I would want to play this just a single level rather than in the campaign, so I could try to just beat this one.
Uh-huh.
And the problem is, if you die, like it might take you a long time to beat the level, and you don't want to finish the whole thing, you just want to try again so you can get the gold. And it's there's no quick mechanism for starting the game over again. You have to go through a whole series of menus. There's no quick restart. If you go to the menu, there's no restart level option. You got to go exit the game, then twiddle through some menus, get to the start again. It's not that big a deal, but I think just pressing the back button to restart would be better. But then Ara suggested that maybe they did that on purpose to
Another curious question that Jamie, I'm sure, will be able to elucidate us on.
I hope so. So we will have Jamie Friestrom, one of the people involved. Wow, I put a typo on our website. I call him the developer. I can't believe nobody caught that. Anyway, we're gonna have him on. I'll have to fix that. We're gonna have him on the show. And if you have any questions for him, feel free to call in at 866-536-1100. I think we already have someone on the line waiting. We're gonna push through the interview for the first or for the second segment of the show, and then take callers. If we have more than the one who's waiting anyway, during the third segment. So sit tight on hold for us, and hopefully by the end of the show, we'll also remind everybody about the PAX event that I'll be running this weekend. And if anyone's going to go to PAX, I want to know about it, because I need some contestants for the show, and hopefully we'll have some Cheddarboxers representing. Anyway, we'll talk to Jamie right after the break.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio. All right, so we're going to have on Jamie Friestrom from Torpix Games to talk about Schizoid.
For the record, he's the technical director and has worked on a lot of the Spider-Man games and Tony Hawk. And
are you with us, Jamie?
I am with you.
He's with us. All right.
That's fantastic.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you're very welcome. I hear you're going to be at PAX this weekend as well.
I am.
Now, what are you doing Sunday morning at PAX?
I'm probably going to be hanging out in the PAX 10 booth demoing Schizoid to people.
I tell you why that's unfortunate, sir.
I think that's the wrong answer.
Because I will be presenting the Family Feud event at PAX this weekend. But if you can get some time off, feel free to check it out. We can get you up on stage. You could be a contestant, Jamie. You could be a contestant on The Feud.
I think I'd get my ass kicked.
No, it's all a team event.
All right. So let's start off by, I hope that we've given a sufficient description. I don't know if you could hear us from the first segment.
Oh, yeah. Of Schizoid. I love the way you guys described the game we're talking about. It was great to hear.
Right on. Okay.
Was it accurate enough? Can we tell the listeners? Okay.
Okay. So now while you're still pleased with us, there's one thing that I when I read your bio on your webpage, the thing that I immediately thought of was that, you know, because you used to work on these big mass market games, right? Like Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man and what was it?
I said Tony Hawk.
Tony Hawk on the Dreamcast, correct?
Yeah.
And so one thing I'm curious about is, and this is kind of like a two-ish parter because I psychically sense some relation between these two things, although maybe I'm wrong. How did the idea of Schizoid come about, and what drew you away from, you know, working on these mass market games to, you know, what you're doing now, which is, you know, Xbox Live style stuff, pretty much?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, there's a dozen reasons why I left Treyarch, and none of them by themselves, I guess, is really big enough to sort of explain it. But sort of all together, I just sort of lost interest in doing the big game. You just feel less ownership. And even though I was working on Spider-Man 3 and I was the creative director, and even as the creative director, I still didn't feel like it was my game, you know? And so I wanted to get away from that. I wanted to create a new company or help create a new company and do a bunch of things different that were sort of locked in the Treyarch culture. And so that's why I left to start a new company. But actually, Schizoid didn't happen until maybe a whole year after that. And we were actually planning on being another one of those mass market licensed titles companies, and we were, you know, going to publisher saying, hey, we just split off from Treyarch, and we've done all this cool stuff, and do you have any ports or licenses you'd like us to do for you? And while we were doing that, we weren't getting a whole lot of traction, and I had some free time, so I started making a game. And it was just a simple little idea that I thought up while sitting at a conference. I was actually thinking about Geometry Wars and how it was such a great use of the two sticks on a gamepad. And I said, well, what if you use the two sticks to, say, control two different ships at the same time? So I made this little game.
Oh, right on.
And that's what became our Uber Schizoid mode, right?
I see. That's really interesting, because I would have imagined it happening exactly the opposite way, almost. And that's just because Uber Schizoid is so freakishly impossible.
Right. It happened the other way, and then immediately, like, I showed it to friends, and they said, "This is freakishly impossible. You're a freak. You don't like this." And
are you actually good at it?
Yeah, I am. I've been playing it. Once we shipped it, I've been playing it, while we were working on it, I did beat it on the dev kit. I haven't yet beat it on my real Xbox.
You mean in Uber Schizoid mode? See, when I was trying to play it, I was like, not only... Go ahead.
You can check the leaderboards. I'm there.
Wow. You didn't have someone else, like, using, you know, the other thumbstick.
I actually did that the first night I played, dude. Had the lady run in the second stick because we only had one controller in the room.
That's funny.
That's actually a great video game trivia. Like, there's this game where we talked to the developer. He couldn't beat his own game.
No, I was just... The thing that got me was I was trying to play it, right? And I almost got to the point where I was like... It's almost like kind of like trying to learn to play piano, right? Because both hands are doing different things.
Right.
But it seems even worse than that, because not only do you have to do that, you have to really keep track of what... I mean, it sounds simple, right? But it's really not. You have to look at both characters, and if they're both not close to each other, it's actually very hard to keep track of and kind of like give each side equal focus, you know?
So it's like learning to play the piano and reading two separate pieces of music at the same time. Maybe. I'm just making that up.
I think so.
There's a big difference. Like, there's a big difference between playing the piano.
Do your eyeballs have to move independent of each other to keep track of the characters?
Do you have this skill, Jamie? Well,
you cheat. There's a whole bunch of crutches you use. You don't really actually multitask. You keep both your ships right next to each other most of the time. And in a way, one of your ships is like your gun, and the other ship is you. And once you think of it in that way, it starts to feel a lot more like Geometry Wars.
Interesting.
That's actually how I thought you have to be successful at Uber Schizoid, is by moving them together. Like in Geometry Wars, if you want to be good, you've got to be shooting essentially in the same direction you're traveling, and always be traveling. So there's not a whole lot of shooting behind you and stuff, at least if you're good at it. And that sort of falls in line here, where both sticks are always going in the same direction, so it's easier to understand. But honestly, I think I'd have a hard time playing this game in Uber Schizoid, even if I didn't have to touch a controller and I could just read my mind, like move red this way and move blue this way. I'd have a hard time.
Well, in some ways, it's easier than co-op, because there are times in co-op where you kind of wish you were psychic, right?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I want to switch places with you now. And in Uber Schizoid, you can do that, because you're talking to yourself. So
getting away from the marvel of Uber Schizoid, I'm a little bit more curious about the development cycle for it. So you had originally determined that this company, Torpex Games, would be working on big titles, and you said it didn't get as much attention as you hoped, so you started building this. And was it essentially just yourself and maybe an artist working on it, or did you devote your whole team? How did it end up working out?
At that point, it was me, and then I showed it to the guy who founded the company. I'm a partner, but he founded it a bit before I did, and then brought me on later. Mm-hmm. And he thought it was cool. And then we happen to know Richard Garfield of Magic the Gathering fame. Are any of you Magic players at all?
I'm not going to pretend that I am.
One of us might be.
Oh yeah, I haven't played recently, but yeah.
So we took it to him, and he was the one who said, "Wow, this is way too hard, but it would be awesome co-op." And so we were actually sitting there, like you said, holding one controller, and each of us was playing a ship. And once we started getting to the advanced levels, we're like, "Wow, yeah, this could be really this could be really fun. And so that's where we took it. And Richard Garfield then came on board, and he and his friend Scaff Elias, the guy who did the Ice Age expansion for Magic and the Magic Pro Tour, they made all the levels for the game.
Wow, Rich is like just going to convulsions of joy right now.
He's apparently upset he's not going to be making it to PAX. All right, well, I've got some more questions for you after the break, so please stay with us. And if anyone wants to call and ask a question, the number is 866-536-1100.
To Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's a number one.
Woo-hoo! And we're back. The Chatterbox Video Game Radio Show is here. If you want to call in, it's 866-536-1100. And if you want to go to school, you should look at uat.edu, the University of Advancing Technology, where myself and Rich both went and enjoyed our time while we were there.
And look where they are now.
Yes. Even if Rich doesn't want to graduate, hey, that's fine. Who cares about graduating? But I did. Good times. Anyway, we've got Jamie Fristrom on the phone with us. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Jamie, I don't want to hurt your feelings. We don't have a lot of callers. It's because the vast majority of our listeners are podcast listeners. And, you know. So they're probably not going to call in live because they're going to be busy listening to it on their iPod tomorrow. But anyway, so I wanted to talk to you about the development cycle of the game. Do we still have Jamie on the phone, by the way?
I'm right here. Can you hear me?
Cool. Yeah, I was expecting all the heavy breathing that we get with all our other callers. So I was curious about the development cycle. I just imagine, since you said you were working on these big titles, that you also had a big team of people. Am I wrong to make that assumption?
You are wrong. The company is basically just Bill and me, and then we brought everybody else on who worked on Schizoid on a contracting basis.
And was that the plan for how you would deal with other larger titles? Had that become a reality?
No. If we had a bigger title, we would probably start hiring permanent staff to do it.
What would you prefer now after making Schizoid? Small game or large game?
They both have their pros and cons.
Yeah.
We're not giving you points here or anything. There's some small games I want to do and there's some big games I want to do.
Right on.
And I hope I get to do them all before before I die or whatever.
Now, wow. Sometimes you have questions and you just lose them in your brain.
I can take over if you want to find them.
No, you go right ahead.
All right. So specifically on Schizoid, I guess, were you then responsible for, you know, pretty much all of the mechanics?
Like I said, Richard and Scaff were huge. They designed most of the enemies. I think the starburster, the little flower that shoots the bullets in all directions, and the idea of having breeders, having these guys laying eggs to hatch more monsters. Those were in my original prototype before they saw it. But pretty much every other monster was something they said, "Hey, let's do something like this."
Was there any kind of monsters that you guys prototyped or had ideas for, and then when you actually, you know, tried that, you were like, "Oh no, this isn't going to work. You can't use this."
There are a couple. There was one that was kind of just like plankton. It was just slow, and it kind of didn't get away very fast. And you just sort of mopped them up, not too interesting. And then there were some squid like things that looked a bit like the squids from the Matrix. They'd fly around in sort of formations, and they were both colors. So you kind of had to pick away at the formation to get at them. Mm. And maybe we could have made that more fun, but as it was, it wasn't that cool.
You know, one of the complaints that Ara had as we were playing last night for an extended period was the stars that are really hard to run away from those and particularly hard to chase as
Those were a big pain in my butt.
How much tweaking went into these enemies? Because Ari was like, you know, I would want to make them just the tiniest bit slower. And I think he was just whining because they're hard. But like, is that sort of thing where you tweaked it up and down, left and right, and eventually settled on this for a particular reason?
Yeah, well, maybe we went too far there. We get so good at the game that the stars to us are sort of like, oh, if we make them any easier, they just won't be any fun anymore. You know, because we've been playing it so long, right?
Yeah, that's what Alon said.
I repeatedly said it's just because Ara sucks. Although he's actually far better at the game than I am.
And there was even one time where it's like, guys, I think this game is too hard. I went in, I slowed him down a bit, and I played it some more, and then I was like, I'm just afraid it's going to be too easy if I do this. And I backed out. I probably should have made him easier.
Yeah, it's something that I've always dealt with in my game development experiences. It's funny because it's so easy to kind of like forget what it's like for somebody to go through that process of learning the game. You know, by the time you're actually making the game and into it, you're just like, you're all experts. And it's funny because even if you do it several times, right, you still like, it takes a lot of like self-discipline. And even then you don't really have exactly, you know, the appreciation of like a first timer kind of hill.
I should have known better because I've been making video games for so long, but part of us were thinking, you know, this is Xbox Live Arcade. These guys are kind of the hardcore of the hardcore.
It's weird because at the same time, it's actually a lot of casual players on Xbox Live Arcade. And I wonder how many people pick up a game based on just a name or a single graphic they see when they're going through the shopping list.
Yeah, that's true also.
But, so I've got a couple more questions that might seem like minutia, but one of the reasons I was excited about this interview is because the game, albeit interesting, is relatively simple in terms of its mechanic. And so I'm really curious to hear about the actual development thought process. And so like I asked about the stars, I'm also, Ara and I were playing again last night, and there was a part where we were wondering if there was dynamic difficulty, because we realized as we played one level...
Oh yeah, the eggs were hatching like way fast all of a sudden, and I'm just like, you guys aren't supposed to be hatching now?
Yeah, we would play it once, and the eggs might take 20 seconds or 30 seconds to start hatching, and then another time we played, and because we just repeated that level a few times, the eggs hatched within just 3 or 4 seconds. And I'm wondering how much randomness versus perhaps intentionally dynamic difficulty went into this.
It's randomness. We're big fans of luck, and we're big fans of random. We're big fans of every time you play a level, it could be something totally different, and it's not about memorization. You know, it's about reacting to what's currently on the screen this time.
That's funny. I like where you're going there, but that actually is really annoying in a couple places. And the part Ara said, this is probably the one thing in the game that I think is completely inappropriate, which is not the level we were talking about with the eggs that hatched at different intervals based on when you played it, but the one that where there's sort of like four distinct quadrants with the black hole right in the center.
Uh-huh.
And you need to get to one particular quadrant, but you can only get there if the black hole decides randomly to send you there.
It's that one with the breeders, is that what you call them?
Yeah, that level's called the breeding pit. I know exactly.
Yeah, the two breeders. And I was like, all right, well, I can tell that they put this in the first like level of that sequence for this reason. But
because you keep restarting it until you...
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really frustrating that basically you have to keep playing until it happens to put you in the right quadrant and puts your friend in his correct quadrant and doesn't, for instance, send the red one into the blue pit where you're bound to die just upon spawn. So
you weren't the only guys who complained about that level.
I didn't think I would be. I'm curious what your defense is.
I like the level. Maybe I'm a freak, but a lot of it is just okay. Keep restarting until you get it right. But you guys mentioned that you wish that there was a restart from the pause menu, and I agree. Actually, although we know we, for whatever reason, we didn't feel like we needed it when we were playing it on our dev kits, but once we got it on our retail boxes at home and we're playing it on the web and or playing over Xbox Live and playing with friends, suddenly we're like, oh, I wish we could just restart these levels easier.
Yes.
Yeah.
See, Elon, developers have these thoughts too.
We've been talking about Braid the last couple of weeks on the show, and one thing that Braid did was offer instant exit of a level. by pressing the back button, which is it's interesting because when you're doing the challenge, the speed runs, it disables that feature, which is when you need it the most. But I'm obviously there's a reason they did that. But yeah, that's really interesting to hear that you agree, yet it was different on the dev kits. I'm wondering, do the dev kits actually run differently? Are they more speedy for some reason?
I just don't know. I just don't know why. We must have just been in a different mindset when we're playing with the dev kits or something, because it's theoretically the same experience.
Well, I'm all for a patch.
But yeah, we'll probably do a title update, and that's one of the things we want to get in there.
Single button press, instant level restart. All right, back button instantly restarts level, which would probably piss a lot of people off when they accidentally hit it. But
personally, I wouldn't do that. But that's
a setting
just
to turn it on would be great.
That's just me.
At least put it on the pause menu, right?
Yeah. Well, if you do it, of course, just make sure to credit a lot.
All right. I want to talk about the AI in this game, and I mean the computer controlled player when we get back. So hang on, everybody. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back again, folks. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio.
We're going to get right back to our interview with Jamie. We've only got a few minutes left, but I do want to remind everyone about UAT.edu, the website for the University of Advancing Technology, where you can learn more about the fields or the things that they offer, where you can become a game designer and developer and then make games like Schizoid. Also, I need to mention before the end of the show that, as you all know, I'll be hosting the Penny Arcade Family Feud PAX Edition event. That's going to be Sunday morning, and we need some contestants for it. So I'm going to pick some at the event, but I also want some Chatterboxers to be involved. I've actually asked Joystick to help pick someone. Hopefully in the next couple of days, they'll have something on their website at joystick.com about picking a contestant. Hopefully they'll get to it, maybe not. But I definitely want people. So email me, Alon@chatterboxgameshow.com, to let me know, and I'll pick randomly out of whoever emails me by the time, well, I guess by Friday. Email me by this Friday, and I'll pick randomly. And also, at the show, if you haven't already been deemed a winner through email, just come up to me, say, hey, I'm a Chatterboxer, and I want in on the feud. I'm a Chatterboxer. I want to play the feud. And I guess I'll just take the first one or two people, maybe three, who knows, who come up to me with the old tagline, I'm a Chatterboxer, and I want to play the feud. And you'll get to go up on stage and play in the Family Feud. And, of course, everyone who plays wins. We'll have a bunch of Penny Arcade money, so you can buy some of their prizes and stuff.
How will they know who you are?
If they don't know who I am, they're not a Chatterboxer.
Okay.
There's a picture of me on the website, man.
Valid argument.
Yeah, you can also go to Joystick and search for Family Feud. You'll find pictures from last year. So, anyway, cool. Let's get back to Jamie. Ara was saying he has all these questions about AI, and I want to...
You still hanging in there?
It. Yep.
All right. Okay, so here's one thing I was really, really curious about, because, and I'm sure you know all about this, the AI seems, and by that I mean the computer player, seems very, 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 very good at dodging and performing in certain situations, and in other situations, it just seems horrendously bad. So was this more of something where it almost seemed like you guys wanted to, you know, make the computer player bad at some things so that the player would, like, protect them, or was it just a matter of, you know, well, you know, it was actually some kind of difficulty or challenge in actually implementing it to do something?
Yeah, it was actually the challenge. I'm not that smart. Thanks for giving me the benefit of the doubt, though.
Anytime. No, it was actually it was funny because you know what are those called? The Astro Amoebas with the little satellites rotating around them, right? It was funny because the AI a lot of times will just the ones that are its color, it will just go right for them, and it feels like it seemed like it didn't even attempt at all to dodge the little satellites, right? Or if there was a satellite that I hadn't cleaned off yet, it wouldn't care. It's like, oh, I'm just going in anyway. And it was kind of cool in a way once you realize that, because then you're like, okay, well, you know that it's not going to try to clean them, so whichever ones are actually coming at it, you have to clean first, and then it's fine. It's not a problem.
Right, and you've got to be careful about what you activate, because he can just get himself killed too easily.
Do you mean power-ups?
Yeah, well, like that, you can pull the Astro Amoebas, right? Like pulling that.
Remember how we were playing? Like they wouldn't come towards us until we got close enough.
Yeah,
I think that's what he means.
Okay, gotcha.
So
yeah, even before I wrote my first line of AI code, most AIs are sort of good tactically and then bad strategically.
Right? Yeah, that's what I mentioned at the top of the show, that making basically a perfect AI is essentially easy, but I think I overlooked some things. It's easy when it has a single goal in mind, and when it has to take into account several things, it's not very easy. And usually it's enemy AI that's just seeking you out, which is easy. But I guess producing a co-op AI is probably significantly more difficult.
Yeah. So we were thinking about that, and we're like, okay, do we invest more time and effort, you know, making the AI smarter on the later levels? Because the AI is pretty good for the first, I don't know, 20, 30 levels, something like that, right? And then
that's what I found.
And then he starts becoming a frustrating liability.
I think we both noticed that.
And part of us is like, mainly like, the real fun of this game is the co-op. So do we want to make the single player better, or do we want to drive people to play the co-op? So that was part of our reasoning.
Yeah,
I could tell in the marketing, like in the menu systems, that you really don't even want people playing the single player. Like you say, it's basically a training ground for the real game, which is personal co-op.
The main reason we had the single player is because up till a game's going to come out soon that's going to change all this, but so far it hasn't been permissible for an Xbox Live Arcade game to have Xbox Live play in the trial. So we're like, well, I guess we need to have a single player mode in the trial.
Oh, interesting.
Just so people will get some taste of what this game is, and hopefully that'll convince them. Hopefully they'll realize playing the single player that co-op would be really fun.
That's awfully interesting. I never would have thought that rules pertaining to Xbox Live Arcade would actually help define how a game is developed. But that's a perfectly good point. They don't want to have co-op play because not everybody who gets the demo, like all the silver people, aren't going to have the gold access and all that.
So, like, you made the AI, this is what I take away from it, you made the AI bad on purpose because you want to encourage people to have friends.
Well, I'd say we didn't throw good money after bad on the AI because we wanted people to play the fun part of the game. And it's fun even without friends. It's like you go on to, I was quick matching with people, I'm playing with random strangers, and I was surprised. Like other games on Xbox Live Arcade, I felt that the people were kind of immature. But when I was quick matching people in this game and we're working together, suddenly it's like a whole level of maturity and friendliness and companionship, and it was really cool.
Do you point out that you're the developer?
Yeah, I was just
going to
ask that.
Sometimes I'll pretend to just be a guy playing the game, and then sometimes I'll tell them right away. I just sort of did it both ways.
Do they believe you if you're just like, hey, I made this game, isn't it awesome? Do they believe you?
They seem to.
So people on Xbox Live are gullible.
Yeah, well, that's true. So what did you learn developing this game, since it was quite a change from your other experience working in larger games? What did you learn from this that you might be able to take away to development in larger titles?
I really learned a lot, just sort of getting back to basics and getting just back to the simple game mechanic, what makes a game mechanic fun. And I really learned a lot from Richard and Scaff. Being able to work with those guys was awesome. The way they approached level design was really cool. Sometimes they start with just a sketch on a napkin. Sometimes they just start with a title. There'd always be some tiny core idea around which they built the level. And it's hard to believe, but on the big games I worked on, like Spider-Man and whatnot, we didn't really have that sort of process. It would be like the levels we would make would be defined by the story, or they'd be random. There was never this Spider-Man could do this and this and this. Let's make enemies that can do this and this and this, and then let's mix them up in these ways and explore all these variations and get this sort of rich palette of what sort of challenges that Spider-Man should face.
I think that helps me identify why I enjoy smaller Xbox Live Arcade style games, I think, more than the traditional big title these days. Like you're saying, it's basically the game evolves around the actual gameplay mechanics. It seems a lot more interesting to me, because I doubt you listen to the show a lot, right? But I talk about all the time how I don't really like playing games that have a lot of story just because I don't care about it. I'll watch a movie for story and I play a game for the interesting mechanic. And a lot of games these days get really boring. And it might be for that very reason. The Xbox Live Arcade games give me a lot more, I guess, bang for the buck. And the buck in this case is my time, where, you know, I only have 15 minutes or an hour or something to invest into a game. And I don't want to deal with a lot of plot or something that doesn't have to do with my actual, you know, joystick and controller.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo the same sentiment. I think that it seems, at least to me, that when you're working in the space of an abstract mechanic, like, you know, for Schizoid, it kind of, like, it seems to really give you a lot more freedom with, you know, what you can do with the design. You know, you're not restrained by, you know, these other components that maybe, like, a narrative-driven game might be restrained by, or maybe a more commercial game might be restrained by. What do you think?
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, I guess
that's okay.
I guess we won't have any time to figure out.
We don't have time left anyway. I do have one really quick question. Next game you're working on, small game live arcade or big game AAA?
Can't really talk about it yet.
Breaking my balls. All right. Well, great. I will see you this weekend. I hope you do find time to come to my event, even though you hate me. And everybody, this has been Chatterbox Video Game Radio with Jamie Freestrom.
I'll do the feed if you can't find anybody else.
I will find you. I will dig you out. Everybody, get over to torpexgames.com and gamedevblog.com to learn more about Jamie and Torpex Games. Thank you very much for being on the show, everyone. Or
we'll
Jamie.
PAX 10 too, PAX.
And PAX 10. We'll be back next week.
Good night, guys.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your bases belong to us.